Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to the EAN Cast, Weekly Neurology, the weekly audio podcast of EAN. My name is Iva Stanković. I am a movement disorder specialist practicing in Belgrade in Serbia. My main areas of research are multiple system atrophy and Parkinson's disease, particularly early differential diagnosis between conditions and biomarkers. This month's topic are hyperkinetic disorders, and in today's episode we will talk about clinical approach to chorea. My guest today is Alessio Difonso, who works as a neurologist at the Policlinico Hospital of Milan in Italy. He is specialized in neurogenetics and rare neurodegenerative diseases and is leading the research team on genetics of movement disorders. So welcome, Alessio, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
My first question for you as an expert on genetic movement disorders would be, how would you define chorea and how a clinician could differentiate chorea from other hyperkinetic movement disorders?
Yeah, so chorea is a term that literally means dense. Is a Greek term. And why we use this term? We use it to describe the random sequence of one or more involuntary movements, or also fragments of movements. And the characteristic of the choreic movements is that they are random. So there is no pattern due to the variability of many aspects, the timing, the duration, the speed. This characterizes the choreic movements. Chorea may be accompanied also by motor impersistence, which is the inability to maintain a voluntary posture of the limbs or the tongues, like the protrusion of tongues that is typical of patients with chorea. And also maybe accompanied by parakinesia, which in which people incorporate some involuntary movement into more intentional movements in an attempt to hide the disorder. So it's very important to recognize this patterns, the absence of a pattern, and to distinguish chorea from other hyperkinetic movement disorder. Chorea can be distinguished by from tremor due to the rhythmic nature of the tremor. This is what is characterizing tremor. Chorea is not rhythmic. Can be distinguished from the athetosis, which is more a sinuous and continuous movement, while chorea is faster, sometimes even shock-like movements, not always, and more discrete movements than those of athetosis, which is more involving several muscles, so the movement is more sinuous. Chorea can be distinguished by from dystonia. Dystonia is characterized by more predictable and stereotyped posture. The mobile dystonia is something that you can predict what is the next movement because there is a pattern. From the myoclonus, which has more rapid nature, rapid spasm, jerk likes, and above all, myoclonic movements are rapid, while in chorea there may be some quite fast movements, but there is some are fast and some can not be fast. While myoclonus, all the movements are very rapid, and this is important for the differentiation. Of course, you can use also electromyography, some neurophysiological tests to very difficult cases to manage the differential diagnosis. And finally, chorea can be distinguished by the tic, since tics can be suppressed by voluntarily and also has a stereotyped nature, while in chorea we don't have this characteristic.
Thank you so much. Could you please share with our listeners a diagnostic algorithm which you use to entangle the etiology of chorea in your clinical practice?
Yes. So this is a very important topic. The diagnosis of chorea and chorea syndromes requires quite effort by the neurologist. I think that the first indication in the differential diagnosis is given by the epidemiology of chorea at different ages. In children, more than 90% of choreas are post-infective choreas, like the Sydenham chorea. So we have to keep in mind that in children, we first have to exclude an acquired cause of chorea, especially the post-infective choreas, which is in the majority of the cases the cause. In adults, the most common cause of choreas is the tardive dyskinesia, so the chorea that is following years of use of antipsychotics. And so this is the first, let's say, information that we have to use when we face chorea syndromes in patients. Then chorea tend to have similar phenomenology, regardless of the cause. So the type of choreas in many forms of many syndromes is not enough to suggest in the etiology of choreas. The differential diagnosis relies, let's say, heavily on the clinical history, of course, so the course of this disease, the associated symptoms and signs. So it's very important to visit patients. The clinical associated symptoms should be noticed. And of course, the age at onset and other information like a family history. The genetic choreas more often have, let's say, a slow insidious onset, positive family history, not always, but it's something that of course is suggesting a genetic form, and more often there is a bilateral involvement. While in acquired forms of choreas, often we have subacute or acute, like in strokes or some of the metabolic syndromes onset. And in some forms of acquired syndromes, we have only specific muscular district can be involved, so can also not be generalized as we see in genetic forms. Of course, this is something that may happen, but not in all cases. So you first may want to rule out causes that require specific intervention. This is very important. It's the goal of our diagnosis. And this requires ascertaining the neuroimaging, which is mandatory, of course, and specific blood and also CNS if we need CSF exams. With this approach, with the neuroimaging, this may reveal the vascular causes of chorea, lesions, neoplastic infective etiology, and also all the forms that are related to accumulation of metals, basal ganglia, copper, iron, manganese, as well blood exams also should be done at the beginning in the differential diagnosis, and this should be include all the vitamins, the heavy metals in blood and also in urine, such as the manganese, the mercury, the thallium, arterial blood exam should rule out the carbon monoxide intoxication, which is a cause of acute onset of chorea syndrome, for instance. And in some cases, also antibodies, autoantibodies that may be suggestive of an autoimmune disease, the SLA, antiphospholipids, of course, the Sydenham forms in children, and some demyelinating diseases, Sjogren's, sarcoidosis, all these autoimmune forms can manifest with chorea. And as well as cerebral vasculitis, but It's very important to rule out the encephalitic, especially the paraneoplastic or post-infective cause of chorea. So all the antibodies against, specific antibodies against potassium channels, CRMP5, Caspar-2, NMDA receptor, IGLON-5, this is very important that are, let's say, examined in cases because there is a therapy, of course, immunomodulation and steroids. So it's very important that this has been investigated at the beginning. In the cases of hereditary and, let's say, neurodegenerative to us, for clinicians, means that we are seeing a worsening, a progression clinically in patients. So in these forms of choreas, of course, the main effort is to exclude Huntington's disease. Why? Because this is by far the most frequent cause of choreas. We must be very convinced that Huntington's disease is ruled out, and this must be done in a laboratory that are, let's say, certified to do the Huntington disease genetic testing, because sometimes false negatives can be a problem, can appear, especially if the genetic test is not done properly. After that, we exclude Huntington disease in the, let's say, unlikely cases, because it's very rare, forms where HD is excluded. So we need an algorithm, because we go to forms that are really difficult to be diagnosed, very, really rare. And so this algorithm is based on the presence of other clinical signs, family history, background, the pattern of inheritance, the ethnic background, of course. And very similar to HD are the forms like HLD1 or HLT2, especially the last one, especially in the African population. So the clinical phenotype is the same, but the ethnic background can suggest, in case of negativity of HD, to investigate also the HDL2. The association with ataxia is something, is a sign that often is preceding chorea, but not always. But the presence of ataxia, of course, should suggest other genetic syndrome, the SCA17, for instance, which may have chorea even before ataxia, or maybe after the ataxia and ataxia, the DRPLA, especially in the Asian, where in Japanese is almost as frequent as Huntington disease in terms of patient with the neurodegenerative chorea. Of course, they also may have epilepsy and ataxia, and also other spinous cerebellar ataxia. Those with the expansion repeats are the more frequent, but also other forms which are rare may have chorea. And the imaging also in the neurodegenerative forms is important to exclude the basal ganglia, familial basal ganglia classifications that may appear as chorea syndrome, as also the NMDA and Wilson. And finally, the differential diagnosis also should be done, especially in children with non-neurodegenerative forms, like those that include the non-neurodevelopmental forms, such the ADCY5. This is important because they have a good response to caffeine, for instance, or the paroxysmal forms. And this is very important because there is a therapy for these forms.
Well, thank you so much for providing this extensive discussion on the differential diagnosis. I think that this would be also very helpful for our listeners to recapitulate this knowledge. So at the end, I would like to ask you, what are treatment strategies for patients with chorea, mainly those that are not symptomatic, but maybe you can also tackle upon a little bit on the symptomatic, as you already did, but maybe something more. And also, other question would be, are there any drugs in the pipeline that you would like to mention here for our listeners?
Yeah. So Of course, the diagnosis should guide the best treatment of chorea, also the symptomatic treatment. Although in generally the haloperidol or the tetrabenazine are the most used drugs to treat chorea, but still, if you have the diagnosis, some specific therapies such as the caffeine for the ADCY5 or the antiepileptics, the carbamazepine for forms of paroxysmal dyskinesias, forms of chorea in children that have really good response to this treatment, then more than the classic antipsychotics, antidopaminergic, let's say. So it's very important, as well as the immune modulators that you can use if you understand, if you find that the chorea is due to antibodies against NMDA receptors or other immune system. So this is the reason why it's very important to recognize the treatable forms among the genetics and also the acquired, the paroxysmal. And of course, for the treatable, if you think the antiphospholipids, autoimmune, you have specific treatments, Wilson disease, which may appear as chorea, as a very, let's say, a specific treatment. And for some of the neurodegenerative, we had some clinical trials, and new trials of phase one trials are coming, especially for Huntington's disease. So it's very important to diagnose patients in order also to enroll for trials that are trying to prove the efficacy of new treatments also for these forms.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.